And we are live at the Conscious Life Expo, February 2019. This is Rob Rose standing in for Debbie Dashinger of the Dare to Dream podcast. I have the very good fortune to be here with Julia Mossbridge. Julia, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks. It's awesome to be here, Rob.
All right. Oh, gosh, so many things to talk about. I'm going to assume that a lot of our listeners will know something about you, so I won't do the usual thing of, you know, tell us how you got here and your whole life story and all that. So I'd like to just jump in. You've got a phenomenal book out right now called The Premonition Code, and I was very fortunate to get my hands on a copy. I've been working my way through it, and one thing that I think is unique about your work, there are many things, but one thing that really stands out is you have a very detailed training program to help people do what you do. And it's a step-by-step, and does it lead to some sort of a certification, something like that?
No. What it leads to, it's funny, we were toying with that. My co-author, Teresa Chung, and I were toying with this idea of a certification. The problem with a certification is that it ends up creating a situation where all these people are writing you saying, why don't you certify me because of X, Y, and Z? And neither of us wanted that. So what we want people to do is rely on themselves to go to the website, to do the work, to develop their own practice in whatever way they want. And then they can go out and use it however they want. Right now, there's no certifying body for people who do this kind of work. Maybe eventually we'll have a standards committee and all that stuff. But right now, it's just the very beginning of the positive precog movement. And it's the very beginning of the precog economy, as we call it. So that stuff just doesn't exist yet. Not quite ready to build that. It may be happening in the future.
Well, that's a super fascinating aspect of it, because it seems that we are, you know, just right on the precipice of a whole new class of careers. You made a very interesting example in the beginning of your book about somebody buying a car and going to a precog at the Nissan dealership or wherever it was, that it was going to give them an idea of whether that's really the best choice for their, you know, personal style of driving, safety, how well that car would work out for them in the future. What are some other examples? You made a couple more in your book. What are other things that people might think about this skill set for,
sure,
as far as, you know, actually going out and functioning in the material world?
Yeah, I mean, basically every area. So we can go down the list. So financially, clearly. Not so hard to think about how to do that. In fact, that if enough people get skilled at this, the rules of the stock market might have to change in some way. But in any case, so financially, it's pretty clear. If you can accurately look into the future at a rate that's higher than, say, 60%, you're going to do well financially. Education. Looking at 5 to 10 years down the road, seeing what kinds of jobs are useful and then training students in those areas could create a country's educational system that's incredibly beneficial because it's looking ahead, right? Healthcare. Someone works in a hospital staffing the emergency room, has to figure out when the accidents are going to be over the next week, staffs the doctors and nurses accordingly because they have this ability.
Really? They can. That's a real thing? You could actually...
If people get to the area where enough people are... The time when enough people are skilled in this area, we're going to find people who are skilled in that particular thing. There are different kinds of skills. There are some people who are really good at looking into mood. Some people are really good at looking at physical elements and not very interested in looking at people. There's other people who are good at looking at biologicals that are non-human, so any kind of animals or aliens, if we ever have those happening around here, or if they are happening. You've got people who are really good at traveling backwards or forwards mentally in time. So just the more these skills become popular and people can get it, that they're not crazy necessarily. I mean, there's crazy people out there, but like that if that they can actually hone the skill and have it be useful, the more we'll find that there are particular people who have abilities that can be used in various areas. So like, for instance, scientific research, right? I'm a scientist. That's really where my passion is. That's why I got into this whole thing. I started training myself in this area because I was studying this stuff. And I felt like an ethnomusicologist who never learned an instrument. I thought, that's ridiculous. I have to learn this. I'm kind of okay at it. I'm not amazing, I don't think, because I've just started, you know. All my life I've had spontaneous experiences, but I've just started controlled precognition where I'm sitting down and I'm doing it. But to me, the science of it is partly compelling because if we could use this ability to actually get insights scientifically, So say you're working on trying to figure out the gene for lung cancer. What if you have a positive precog who works alongside you, knows all the lingo, and can say, well, it looks like in 6 years we find it on gene 33. Well, maybe we can make that 2 years instead
of... You could change the needle in the haystack to the needle in a small pile of straw, then.
Yeah, except there is no gene 33, sorry. I mean, chromosome 33, sorry. But yes, if we were another species. But yes, right, you could hone and speed up scientific research, including research into things like precognition. So it could be very circular.
You mentioned something a minute ago I kind of have to ask you about. You were talking about the emergency room and predicting accidents. Now, the word accidents seems to imply that it's a random occurrence, or else it wouldn't be an accident. So is that a real thing? I mean, is there really some way to tell if some guy is texting in his car and he swerves and hits another car or something like that?
Do you mean look into the future to see that?
Yeah. As far as predicting, you know, the week's worth of future accidents and then the emergency room, like you were talking about, is that?
Yeah, I mean,
really reality?
It's not reality yet, but I think it will be reality. So it's one of these things where I'm looking sort of forward into what I think is probable, and I think that there are people who are really good at predicting. I know that there are people who are good at predicting accidents. Now they're not working in an emergency room doing staffing, but and when you say that. You know, when you use the word accident, it makes it sound like it's kind of a oxymoron because we're talking about predicting an accident, and I see what you're saying. But, you know, we don't, right now, the scientific community is kind of in a transition decade, or maybe two decades, where there's very little agreement about what's going on with time. So you've got some people who are very, you know, very sure that you... we all live in this block universe, and everything that will ever happen exists kind of like a loaf of bread, and we're going through these slices of bread. And so if you're going to get in an accident, you're going to get in an accident, period. And there's other people who think that you're looking at probabilities. So there's an 80% probability that on Thursday you'll get into an accident, you know? But you also, we don't know if you're going to be on the 20% side or on the 80% side, right? And if you don't get in the accident, it didn't happen to you, and you'll say, well, you were wrong. But, you know, it's just...
Where do you place yourself in that spectrum of debate?
I'm feeling like I struggle with it literally every day because I go back and forth on the physical evidence looks like it's kind of both from the physics. The sort of philosophical arguments look convincing on both sides. The neuroscience data you could also explain. So, like, everything looks like it's sort of... equivocal, meaning that either argument could work or either story could work. My feeling, this is an intuition, and all of these, at a certain point, the data sets stop, and then it's all interpretation and intuition, right? And that's kind of the fun part of science, looking at the data and then coming up with some kind of interpretation. And so for me, where I'm at is this intuitive interpretation, which could easily be just 100% bunk. But having said that, I feel like there's these, God, every time I say this, I feel like in 3 years I'm going to be like, that was so wrong. But on the other hand, I feel that every time I say something like this, and sometimes I'm right.
That's okay. That's true of probably most scientists.
Yeah.
I think the name of the game is being willing to revise your views based on new data, right?
Yeah, and the name of the game is not knowing. As soon as you know, you're definitely for sure wrong when you know.
Yeah.
I definitely don't know if this is true. This idea that there's, I'm putting my hand in a fist, like the fist is like, there's a landmark here in space-time, and then there's a landmark here in space-time and a landmark over here. So let's say there's three landmarks, A, B, and C. And those things kind of have to happen. Like, those are embedded in space-time. Those are going to happen. But how you get from landmark A to B and B to C is up in the air. And I call this the landmark and path model. So there's the landmarks, and then there's the path. And so there's some lack of predetermination in the path, but there's predeterminations in the landmarks. The reason this is so unsatisfying to, one of the reasons this model would be so unsatisfying to physicists is because they're trained to believe the universe is not personal. So what's a landmark for me, in this, they would think would have to be a landmark for everyone else, but that doesn't seem to be how it works. Intuitively, it seems like the ones that are important to me don't matter to you at all. You could be walking by on the street while my mother's dying of cancer, and that's a landmark for me.
Absolutely.
And it's not for you. So it ends up suggesting that the universe is very personal. But I think there's other reasons to suggest that the universe is very personal.
But you could scale that in any direction, I would imagine. You could say, what is the trend for a community? What is the trend for a city?
Yeah, yeah, you could start...
A country, a
world.
A population, a species.
Yeah.
So I can't help but wonder, I'm sure you give it thought to this, as fast as our world is changing in so many ways, and technology and these types of things, sort of, non-quantifiable sciences, really is science, but we're still so early that, we can't point to, real serious blocks of data and say this is exactly what it is and this is why. We're still kind of dealing with a lot of unknowns, even though we know that we're dealing with a type of science. How do you think about how society might change or culture might change in just the very near future, 3 to 5 years? Are we heading in a good direction? I'm sure we're heading in multiple directions. Do you have any thoughts about how all of this rapid change? We're clearly at the steep part of the hockey stick in so many ways.
Yeah.
Where do you see us going?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I think everyone always thinks they're at the steep part of the hockey stick. I think every generation thinks they're at the steep part of the hockey stick because they are, because it's always change is always faster than it was in the past. It keeps speeding up, and so it's true that you're always at the steep end of the hockey stick because of that. The hockey stick is exponential.
But in say the 1700s,
yeah.
One decade was probably very much like the next.
Well, that's what it looks like to us.
One decade is very, very different.
That's what it looks like to us. But back in the 1700s, they're like, have you seen those new wheels on those carriages? Yeah. Things aren't changing so quickly, right?
Okay.
I mean, it's all relative. But in terms of the future, people ask me that a lot. And it's starting to become this risk because while I am a scientist who has all these intuitions and I work on intuition, I do have controlled precognition practice. And I'm decent at it, but I'm not amazing. I'm not the right person. I'm sort of not the right person to ask about that. And yet I want to answer because I have intuitions about it. So I'm going to answer in two different ways.
Okay.
One way is to tell you the right person to ask about it, or not the right group of people, is Stephen Schwartz has this project called the 2050 Project. Stephen Schwartz is this researcher who's done just tons of remote viewing work and has found a lot of, you probably know about him, your listeners probably know, but...
I will definitely find out. I'm not personally familiar, but sounds like a really interesting guy.
Yeah, and he did a bunch of archaeology projects where they go find, they use remote viewing to go find artifacts.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They do it very successfully. But he also has this project of asking excellent remote viewers to look into the year 2050 and find out what it's like. And he only sort of talks about the pieces that multiple viewers have come up with.
Okay.
As a way to sort of get some kind of... Yeah, because, of course, we can't test if he's right yet, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the things he came up with that I really... coming back to my intuition, that I intuitively feel will happen, that will be very positive, is finding a source of energy that is practically free, if not free, and extremely plentiful. And that's going to shift... So that, and then teleportation... And now Stephen didn't ever talk to me about teleportation. I don't know if his remote viewers see that. I see that like crazy. Like, do you know how much of our culture is about getting one thing to another place?
It's kind of like getting 3D printing to the absolute, maximum it can be, and, transporting the physical structure just via electronic information
right.
to another place.
Right, or a person.
And then your uploadable consciousness in turn, because our neurons, function in a binary fashion, right? Which theoretically
no, can... let's just nip that puppy in the bud.
Oh, they don't?
That's
what I'd heard somewhere.
So. No, I know. Please. But when I was in college and the teachers were telling us that neurons are binary, they hit a threshold and that's 1 or 0, I just felt, just like these other things that people say, there's certain things where I can feel that it's not true. And I knew that it wasn't true. And I didn't find out until about 15 years later, why? And it's because there is a threshold, but there's also a graded response. The graded response matters. The glial cells around the neurons have this graded response. That's not 1 or 0. That matters. And it turns out just very recently there was a discovery that electrical fields that are produced by the brain can jump from one part of the brain to another part of the brain without connections and cause an impact on the neurons. So... Right. We don't understand how the brain works is a really good summary of how the brain works.
Okay.
So the point is, I don't know how we'll be teleporting people, but I have this. So those two changes, the plentiful energy and teleportation of people and first objects and then people, is really going to change the structure of how things work, because there's so much of our culture that's around moving things from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
Like all these roads, not so necessary if you can teleport people everywhere and objects everywhere, right? All these cars, very different.
In terms of teleportation, what happens to the original body? The original body vanishes and appears somewhere else, or a duplicate of the body is scanned and then reconstructed somewhere else?
Yeah, we're going to have to figure that out.
Yeah, you think?
Seems like we would double the Earth's population pretty quickly.
If that kind of thing is coming, and 3D printing gets to the point where it can construct organic matter and then infuse it with life somehow, even on a cellular level, which is really not that far-fetched.
I mean,
people are heading in that direction
sure. Now. Yeah.
Do you get any intuition that we're headed to a point of conquering death?
I don't know. That's one of those things I don't care about. So okay. The problem is that I feel like this idea of conquering death, it's just an egoic fantasy about, like, the desire of the individual to live forever.
Okay.
So I don't care. Like, I hope we don't conquer death, because then people will get to decide that they're powerful forever.
Yeah, then it becomes a thing with the haves and the have-nots, and, we get into the Elysium
type. Well, also, people don't get to have the amazing insight that comes when you don't have your body, and you're like, oh, thank God, I'm done with this body.
Okay. So as far as the sort of ascended view of time, where time becomes like simultaneous and you can go different points in time, let's take it backward, because I'm really a history buff, especially ancient.
Oh, you want to go to the past? Like, I never think about the past.
Can that be done? Can you get together with a historian and say, hey, look, with one of the Peloponnesian Wars, we know this and this and this, but we don't know this.
People who are good at that. There are remote viewers who do retrocognition as opposed to precognition, which is sort of my focus. And so they do mental time travel to the past, and they get information. And I think Stephen Schwartz, because he does this archaeology stuff, he uses some of those folks to find out what happened and therefore where might we find this artifact. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
So like if I'm on the ship that's going down, what's it like and what's it look like around me, and then where might I find the artifact? So I think you're going to have a really good conversation with Stephen.
Oh, so that's happening now, huh?
Wow. Yeah, he's doing that stuff. Yeah.
Oh, very exciting. I've got to get him in touch with Daniele Bellelli and Dan Carlin. Now there's a two of my favorite history podcasters. Those guys are
oh yeah, you have to do that.
Amazing. I'd love to make that connection.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to hook that up.
And Daniele Pilelli's a history professor at UCLA.
Cool.
And he's got a very successful podcast, and he's made what can be a very dry subject, he's made it vibrant and exciting to everybody.
Cool.
And I just absolutely love his work. He's got this really thick Italian accent. So he's,
cool, clearly,
he's talking
yeah.
about Italian history. it fits right in. He's got one on Caravaggio.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of stuff on Rome. And you talk about these guys with their swords strapped on, spreading through the streets of Venice in the 1400s or something like that. I mean, it just comes alive.
That's amazing.
He's great guy. So he would love this kind of stuff.
I'm wondering if you're interested in, there's one thing I'd love to get out there when I do podcasts, if you're interested in talking about, is the emotional and spiritual changes that people go through when they pick up controlled precognition as a practice. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because that's something, so my husband's Brooks Palmer, he's sitting here too, and he's seen me train myself in controlled, should we...
We still have some time. Okay. Looks like somebody might be starting at 1, but okay. We're good.
Okay. So my husband, Brooks Palmer, who's here, he has watched me train myself and get trained. My trainer was John Vivanco, and now he's my teacher. We teach, I should say that again. He was my original trainer for controlled precognition. He called it remote viewing. I do a subset of remote viewing called controlled precognition, where no one knows what the target is, and no one in the world knows what the target is until it's revealed after you're done gathering the information. And now John Vivanco and I teach classes on this together, and we both see people transform their lives, because what it's doing is you're learning about yourself. You're going inside to find this information from the whole rest of the universe. it is the coolest thing ever. And my life has really developed a center around my controlled precognition practice. And I thought maybe my husband could say a few words about that, because he sees me get stressed out in the day and, you know, having a usual day with all the busyness, and then go into my office and go do my controlled precognition, and then he sees me come out.
Absolutely. Brooks, take it away.
Well, I could say that it's like if she had gone to sit and meditate for a while, because when she comes out of doing the controlled precognition, because she's in her office and the door's closed, you know, she comes out and she looks refreshed. She looks brighter, like she took a nap, you know, and there's a certain peacefulness about her. And I also think, too, that it comes very naturally to her to do this, the precog work. But I do think that it has a way for a person to go with, and you could say, and use those natural instincts that are there, but usually just untapped. And it creates a vibrancy, because I think a person's internal space expands. So they're no longer, when you get tired, you get stressed, you get constricted, and then everything's overwhelming. But by going within in this particular way, there's an expansiveness that comes, and you get a peace of mind as a result of that. And your intuition gets a lot more vibrant, I think a lot more sensitive. You're able to pick up clues and signals that are just basically out there, like radio waves. Awesome. And I think she taps into that.
Well, let me ask you about something else in that regard. Are there any substances one can use, any kind of enhancers, any plant medicines, anything like that, that can further this work? Because you talk about like getting in a meditative state, and oftentimes, you know, as great as meditation is as a practice, people can sometimes meditate for years before they, you know, really see any tangible results. But, you know, if a person uses a plant medicine of some sort, they're pretty well guaranteed something's going to happen. And if they're in the type of environment that's, you know, controlled and, you know, very mindful, oftentimes, you know, some very good things can happen. There can be some very useful results. Do you have any experience with this type of approach?
So I stay away from plant medicine because of a family history of mental illness. And so I'm very clear about that for me. But I created this website at thepremonitioncode.com. If you click on positive precog training, it's totally free, and you can take yourself through the practice with randomly selected images or words that show up as your target. And so that's all explained in the book, too, so that in the premonition code, so you can learn how to do that. Mm-hmm. And the point is that people can then experiment. So some people I know are really interested in plant medicine. Other people are interested in ketamine. People are interested in having an orgasm and seeing if after sex they perform better. You know, so I just wanted to give everyone the tool, because I don't want to have to deal with the institutional review board process of having to request illegal substances to do an experiment. It's easier just to let people do legal substances in a clinical setting that's mindful and play with this free resource and see. And that I want to create a community where people can experiment and have other scientists, they can use that resource as a way to do their experiments. I just want it out there so that we can have a whole world of people who are starting to learn about their own skills. Anyone can do this at a basic level. And if you practice because you're dedicated to it and because you enjoy it, you can get better and better. And you don't have to use any substances, and maybe some substances help. I'm noticing that I think my hormonal cycles make a big difference, and I've talked with several other women where that's the case. And so I think there's a lot to learn here, and I just encourage people to try it and learn it and be safe, be careful, and yet have fun.
Well, that's interesting. You just by the simple act of doing your work, you would emerge feeling better. Do you find yourself in a, I don't know what the right word is, a dimension, another level of consciousness that is more vibrant with energy, and you find yourself, you know, get it infused with that energy somehow?
Experience is almost like this reality that we're sitting in right now is sort of the story reality, and that when I go in and do my controlled precog practice, I'm getting in touch with reality. So it feels okay. more real to me. And it's more, I feel more full of myself, like full of life. I feel like I'm really there, really doing it, really in contact with sort of the universe that comes to me. And so it feels like the opposite of a drug trip. It feels like a sanity trip almost.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is really cool.
Yeah. It's very grounding and it's satisfying and it makes, the other thing it does is, by the way, because I work with my future self and ask her questions, like the self that knows the answer to the question, like, hey, is it like this or that? And I've developed this loving relationship with my future self where we send love back and forth over time. That's how it feels. I mean, it could be a metaphor. I don't care what it is, but it feels like that. And I feel like that has made me so much stronger and authentically connected to myself because it's like I'm safe. My future self is there. I'm here. Like, I'm good. It feels good.
Now, when you're working with students, and either in your online community, or I don't know if you work with people personally in live classes or anything like that, what is a way for a person to know, or for you to be able to tell somebody, say, hey, you're gifted at this. This is something you can really pursue and do well, versus somebody that says, you know, look, as interested you as you are in this, it's going to take a lot of hard work for you to succeed.
It's easy to tell because we use, that's the great thing about controlled precognition. We use randomly selected targets. So you do your session, which means you're, for the most part, for most people, they're drawing on a sheet of paper, writing down their impressions and words and adjectives, and trying to sense into what the target is. And then when it comes time to get the target, it's very clear if they've contacted the target. And if they repeatedly have trouble, either don't get any impressions or repeatedly cannot contact the target, maybe after trying for, 3 months or something, then it's likely that they'll need to do a lot more work than most people to get it. But most people, the first time out, get some kind of impression of the target and over time improve immensely.
What percentage of the general population would you think has enough of a natural gift at this to be successful in some degree, even if they wanted to maybe do...
As a career, you mean?
Either as a career or to have it be useful to them.
Yeah, if they wanted to do
personal,
like...
personal stock trading or something.
Or just help their friends with their career choices or whatever it is, sure. I think has a gift. No one walks in the door and immediately is operational because they need to learn kind of the technical elements of it. But let's say 1% of people are pretty close to almost operational when they walk in the door. And then I would say another 40% of people don't need much, maybe a year of practice.
Oh, okay.
And then the remainder probably would never do a year of practice because they would hate it because they would... You know how you like things you're good at?
Mm-hmm.
So sure. I think that other group of people would probably not like it because they wouldn't feel good at it.
Is it like musical talent a little bit?
I think it's like musical or athletic talent. Like most people, you can get them to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star on the piano.
Yeah.
You know, but some people come in and you play that and then they go, I wrote the symphony, you know.
Awesome. Well, I think we're probably running short on time here. Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know about your work or how to find you or anything that's just up to the minute, latest and greatest in this particular field?
Sure, latest and greatest. Let's see, you can always go to mossbridgeinstitute.com to find out whatever I'm up to. Also, thepremonitioncode.com. Click on events and classes, and I have an Insight Timer class people might be interested in. And then I'm always doing, John Favanco and I are always teaching and online. We do online classes. They're fairly affordable. And I think mostly I'm really interested right now beyond those classes and beyond precognition, I'm interested in trying to understand the mechanisms of time. And so I created a crowdfunding experiment that has to do with quantum mechanics and time. And you can learn more about that at, I think it's www.tinyurl.com/futurephotons.
Okay.
So.
Well, that is awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Yeah, and thanks, Rob.
It has really been awesome and been enlightening. Once again, this is Rob Rowe standing in for Debbie Dashinger at the Conscious Life Expo, February 2019. Over and out, and see you online.
See you online. Thanks, Rob.
Sure.
That's a nice conversation. The way you work is...